Hello. Welcome to Adventures of an Inspired Amateur, a podcast created to explore the strange insides and curious outsides of the many, often obscure, musical worlds that have inspired Book of Kills to produce hundreds of songs over the past 30-odd years. I'm Jim Shelley, and I'll be your host and humble guide for this 30 minutes of analysis, introspection, and reminiscence, and a big helping of Book of Kills music. Thanks for listening. And now, here's this week's episode. In 1987, 88, and 89, my friend Gary Bug and I sponsored what was essentially a glorified talent show for charity called Rock Night at the local high school where we both taught. All 3 years were a big success. We raised several thousand dollars, and we gave a lot of kids in our school the chance to display their musical skills to a pretty big audience. Gary and I both performed as well in bands we temporarily threw together just for the events. The first year, we drew a huge crowd, so big, in fact, that kids were literally climbing out onto the rafters to see the stage. It was something else. My little unnamed band went on last, and I'll never forget the reception we received. I still have a boombox recording of the show. After the 88 show, I developed a nagging little problem. I couldn't get music out of my mind. In years past, it had been easy to put away my guitar and forget music because I'd been busy with work and family-related matters. But now I felt something different going on in my heart and my mind. In truth, it had been bubbling in my subconscious for months, if not years. I wanted to write songs, and I wanted to record them. No, make that, I had to write songs, and I had to record them. I don't know exactly what had happened to cause the change. All I knew was that I'd developed a desire to create that I couldn't deny anymore. Maybe things had simply been welling up inside me for years, and now the dam had finally burst. I set up a little studio in the attic of our house and laid down the only two songs I'd written in years, one called Revelation, and more importantly, one called The Night John Lennon Died. We'll be right back. The lyrics for The Night John Lennon Died came almost verbatim from a three-verse poem I'd written in a poetry workshop I sponsored at the high school. For recording, I had a task on Porter Studio 244 four-track cassette deck that I'd bought back in the early 80s, a cheap drum machine, an Ovation bass guitar, which I still use to this day, a Gibson SG, a few effects pedals, and a Shure SM57 microphone. This song is unusual for me because I tuned my guitar to an open A minor chord. That way I could just bar up and down the neck of the guitar with one finger and create a bunch of arpeggiated chord variations, something I probably couldn't have done otherwise. An arpeggiated chord is also known as a broken chord, which is a group of notes played one after the other, up or down in pitch. The notes of the chord are played individually rather than together. I learned the technique by listening to Beatles songs. George Harrison and John Lennon were masters of using arpeggios in their work. Good examples would be Dear Prudence, I Want You, She's So Heavy, and Because. I also sampled a brief passage from a Sonic Youth record and reversed the tape, sped it up, and tacked it on to the end of the song. I'd never used a special tuning or a sample before. I guess you'd have to say that The Night John Lennon Died was the very first Booker Kill song, though in 1988 there was no Be Okay Yet. I'm quite proud of the song in terms of lyrics, musicianship, and arrangement. It was far beyond anything I'd ever done before. And then, nothing. I suppose the problem was that I immediately began to rationalize. Maybe I was beginning to feel the compulsion to write songs, but what was the use really of recording them if no one was going to hear them? I didn't have an answer to that question. I tried to stifle the need, and it was a need, to write only partially successfully. I still found myself going about life with a constant nagging voice in my head that babbled lyrics and melodies almost from the moment I woke till I laid my head on my pillow at night. Sometimes I couldn't sleep because ideas for songs would be echoing through my mind. In the spring of 89, Gary and I sponsored our last rock night together. This time, he and I put together a brief set of classic folk rock covers that we performed with another makeshift band of students and teachers. Playing other artists' material was fun, and it was a good way to learn how to write your own stuff, but well, I figured I'd learned enough, and I wanted to play and write my own songs. When the school year ended, I was burning up with musical ideas. It was finally time. It was time to make a Book of Kills album. I wrote and recorded the tracks pretty much in the order that they appear on Bloom or Die, which is what I ended up naming the album. The title refers to the feeling I had at the time that if I didn't start making music on a regular basis, I was going to have to kill a part of myself that I knew was integral to who I was as a person. If I didn't allow the songs to come pouring out, I was pretty sure I'd end up becoming some sort of 9-to-5 Robotron who was as good as dead. Shortly before I started work in earnest on Bloom or Die, I bought a Tascam Porta 1, a smaller, cheaper version of the 244, the machine I already had, so that I could bounce four tracks from one machine to a second one, much the way the Beatles did before they gained access to an 8-track machine in 1968 while they were working on the White Album. I really didn't have the money to buy the second deck, but I bit the bullet and paid for it with my credit card. I figured I could worry about making the payments later. Being able to bounce tracks back and forth, though I rarely did more than record four tracks and mix those four down to one or two tracks and then record two or three additional tracks on the reduction tape, gave me the opportunity to add a couple more instruments or vocals than my previous recording setups had allowed. I was even capable now of creating some simple effects, such as panning a track or two back and forth across the stereo listening field. And right now is probably a good time to say a word or three about the Tascam Porta Studio. Launched in 1979, the original Porta Studio 144 allowed musicians to cheaply record and produce music at home. The model I purchased, the 244, back in 1982, featured better overall sound quality and more features, including DBX noise reduction. What it all did was lead to a decentralization of virtually all recording. For better or worse, anyone could make a multi-track recording anywhere. Today, professional quality audio can be recorded just about anywhere you can find a power source. Today, we no longer have limitations when it comes to the number of available tracks, and that means unlimited takes. Tape-based Porta Studios were limited, severely limited, in the number of tracks you could record with, initially just four, with the 244, and later in the late 90s, with the 488, you could record with eight tracks. I think having unlimited takes has made us lazy. We've lost that sense of urgency to try to perform our very best and capture a great recording in a few takes. That was part of the magic of recording back before digital. It was a real challenge to get that once-in-a-lifetime performance. And more importantly, having that pressure to produce created a unique sense of focus that we've lost today. Limits and parameters make us better musicians. I really believe that. And I think it makes for better recordings. Your imagination is unleashed by constraints. You break out of your creative box by forcing yourself to step into shackles. Limitations are provocative. They're challenging. They wake you up. They make you better. When you have less to work with, you actually begin to see the world differently. Limitations force you to act more resourcefully, to figure out new ways to be better. When I only had four or eight tracks to work with, I gave myself the freedom to use resources in less conventional ways because I had to. The situation demanded a mental, creative license that otherwise would have remained untapped. All right, I'll step off the soapbox and get back to Bloomer Duh. Since my studio was located upstairs in the attic, and I was going to be working during the heart of summer, I had to record as early in the day as possible. The house faced east, and by 10:30 or 11 in the morning, the temperature in the attic was usually in the mid to upper 80s during the late morning, and significantly hotter than that by the afternoon. So I had to work quickly. Fortunately, the music for Bloom or Die came quickly and easily. The chords and melodies just seemed to pop into my head. As soon as I'd work out one song, another one would be waiting in my brain to fall into the tape recorder. It was almost too easy. The lyrics were another matter. I felt things, but I couldn't verbalize them very well. I didn't want to write the sort of words I'd used on 12 songs, my first album back in 1983. Things were different now. I was different now. Emulating the Beatles or the Stones, that was the last thing on my mind. Now let me backtrack a moment. Back in 1987, a senior English major from James Madison University had called me out of the blue. I never did learn how he heard of me. And asked me if I had some poems I'd like to submit to JMU's new literary magazine called In Earnest. I sent him a couple of things, including a long piece I'd written about an old girlfriend of mine, and both of them found their way into the first edition of the magazine. There was some cool stuff in Earnest, and it struck me that one way I could come up with some ideas for lyrics would be to borrow a line or two of other people's material and then build off of them to flesh out a song. Of course, poetry and song lyrics are two different things, so I usually had to jigger the material I stole to fit the confines of whatever song I was working on at the time. And I realized that I had quite a bit of material that I'd written, as poetry largely, that I could plunder as well. And before I knew it, the lyrics were shaping up nicely. Now, the arrangements I heard in my head were usually beyond what my very limited technical abilities as a guitarist or bassist or singer accommodated. So I often found myself playing or singing a part over and over, sometimes for half an hour or more, until I'd finally nail it, or accidentally come up with something better. I got pretty good at doing reduction mixes as well. That's where you record two or three tracks of various voices and or instruments, and combine them all onto one free track, thus allowing you to go back and use the now available other tracks to record other stuff. I got to where I could record four different instruments or voices on one deck, make a reduction mix of the four tracks onto one track of the second deck, then record two more tracks on the new tape and reduce them onto one track, and then record two more tracks. That, in effect, gave me an 8-track recorder and still relatively decent fidelity. My musicianship improved quite a bit in a short period of time, and I learned to play rhythm very precisely. When you're recording with a drum machine, you're either keeping near perfect time with your instrument or you have to start all over again until you get it right. And like I mentioned previously, I learned persistence as well. I usually wrote and recorded songs simultaneously and would come up with the bass and guitar parts on the fly. I rarely tend to work parts out ahead of recording, at least I didn't in the old days. And I like the feel you get in recordings when you haven't practiced everything to death. The song sounds a lot more live and energetic. Maybe it's rawer than the sound you get in a real studio, or nowadays with digital. But I always preferred the rough and ready sound of home recordings over the slick sound you get in a professional studio anyway. Now, though my memory is understandably a little cloudy on the details of the recording sessions for Bloom or Die, I do recall a few specifics. The first thing I wrote and recorded, I Hang Heavy, turned out to be one of the more popular songs of mine as far as live shows go. I used a few lines from a poem in Earnest to come up with the chorus. I think I was trying to emulate the Pixies on that one. I took the simple lyrics for The Big Sleep from a 1976 Patti Smith bootleg recording that I owned. I remember she was improvising those exact lines in the song at the end of a performance of some cover song she was rampaging through. Face was inspired by Wire's Pink Flag album, though that's about all I remember about that one. The words for Believe came from one of the first songs I ever wrote back in the late 70s. It was a really poppy thing, but I turned the version on Bloom or Die into a simple, sludgy, hard rock number. I didn't know how to play a hot, hard rock solo, so I came up with a break in the middle as a way to distract from the fact that I wasn't a very good guitar player. Necessity is, as I've said before, the mother of invention. The Girl Can't Help It is sort of a weird combination of Husker Du and Elvis Costello. It's always been one of my favorite songs of mine. I've always been a great admirer of John Lennon's and Elvis Costello's lyric writing. Their love of subtle, playful wordplay and puns is, it's almost a lost art today. I can't stand cliched lyrics. Although, you know, we all use them once in a while, I guess. But if you have to use lines like "I'm down on my knees, I'm begging you please," or "cold as ice," or "I love you girl," well, just don't. Hold On is a very strange song. When I first started writing it, around the time John Lennon was assassinated and in late 1980, I was trying to come to terms with how anyone could justify in their minds snuffing out the life of such a brilliant artist and depriving the world of so much future joy. I wasn't successful, because there's never any justification for murder. But I'm kind of proud of the sound of that track. I came up with that chicka chicka bass sound by running the guitar through my Boss delay pedal with a real tight echo repeat setting. I think the solo is pretty cool too, especially for someone who hardly knew how to play guitar at the time. Stole the chorus, "You're a bucket full of sickness and a meaningless life," in "Bucket Full of Sickness" from a Alice Donut song. I'm not proud of it, but the song turned out pretty cool. The lyrics I pretty much just improvised on the spot as I recorded. They're more or less sound for sound's sake. They're not bad either. And I like the screams. I took a break in early August for a week's vacation with the family in Virginia Beach. I remember the night before we left, I was up till early in the morning, finishing the recording of "Sleep's Too Short a Death." The guitar solos on that song are all live. There's no overdubbing going on. I finally nailed the last solo about 4 hours before I was supposed to drive the wife and kids to the beach. I decided to just stay awake. It was a tough ride down, but we had a great time once we got there. Though to be honest, I spent a good deal of our stay thinking about getting back to Dayton and finishing up the album. We got back just a couple of days before school started back up, and I knew if I didn't finish before then, the album might never turn out the way I'd conceived it. I wanted Bloom or Die to run as close to 30 minutes as possible without going over. That way I could put the whole album on each side of a 60-minute cassette tape, which ran 30 minutes in each direction. If you bought a copy of the album, when one side was done, you could just flip the tape over and press play and listen to it again right away. Now, I needed a big production number to end the album, but I was at a loss as to what sort of song to write. Then I remembered an old recording I'd made from the late 70s called Normal. I came up with the music and I did the recording quickly, then rewrote a few of the lyrics from Normal to lay over the music. But I made up most of the rest of the words as I sang the song, which I decided to call I Just Wanna Be Normal. The lead vocal was a first take, which was fortunate because I tore up my throat so badly singing it that I threw up as I spewed out the last couple lines, and I couldn't have done another run through of the song if my life had depended on it. I guess the song reflected the strange sense of dissatisfaction I'd been feeling lately, in spite of the comfortable life I'd constructed for myself. I'd begun to feel that I had so many good things going for me, and yet so few of them seemed to offer me any gratification. I only had about 28 minutes of material. The next morning, after my wife, Mary Lou, had gone to work and the kids had gone outside to play, I wrote one final song, Live My Own Way, and committed it to tape all in less than an hour, and the album was finished. By the way, that little bit of angry, fake telephone conversation at the beginning of Live My Own Way was actually a recreation of a real telephone conversation I'd had earlier that week, but I have no recall now of who I was talking to or what I was so angry about. Man, that whole album is angry. I should have just called it I'm Really Angry. Anyway, I'd done it. I'd recorded a real album, or at least a semi-real album. Now, what was I going to do with it? That was the question. Well, that's a story for another podcast. Till then, see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Fuck you! You don't know what you're talking about. Listen.